session now. What I'd ask you to do is you can address your question to whoever you like, or all three of the panelists will take a crack at it. If you would push the button, get near a speaker, and introduce yourself. And I think a red button will go on to make notice. So I'll just ask, they can come to the front, and you guys can share the mic up here. So I have a question over here. You'll see a light go on.
Good afternoon. My name is Sam Tota. We have difficulty to choose among the speakers. They were all excellent, but I will go for the first one, honorary Joe Clark. I had the pleasure to listen to you many times, and I came to get your card. So I'll have one comment, which is a little bit sensitive. But before I make that comment, among the institutions that non-government have created, the Internet is very important, and that one you bypassed it, and it is really changing our world, okay? That's positive. Number two, when you presented to us a graph, the only time you presented the graph, and you stated, or the broker stated, that Canada will be number 17th among the nations in 50 years' time, and that worries you. Last time you presented that graph, I mentioned to you it is not what we want to see in that graph. That graph represents GNP, which is gross national product, and it does not represent what our new values are. So the point I'm trying to make, you promised not to show it to the public again because it really doesn't represent.
Let me give you a question. Do you have a question for anyone of the speakers? I'll get you to ask it.
The question is not to represent graphics that are old cliches that do not represent today's thinking. Let me give you an example. That graphic will not represent the number of women that are dying every day while giving birth. And in Canada, we can prevent that. Whatever you do in that graphic, it will not include it. I am pretty sure you want a better world, but in order to have
if there's no question, just comment. There's lots of people with questions, and I'm going to have to close you down.
Well, that was the question, to choose the right graphic to represent our new values.
It's a directive. So anybody have a question here? Next question here.
Thank you very much. My name is Lambert Okra. I work with a charitable organization called the Institute of Cultural Affairs International. I'm very happy to be here, and I thank the organizers for organizing this. My comment and question goes to Right Honorable Joe Clark and then the last speaker. Not only is Canada shrinking in the area of development and diplomacy abroad, but it seems to me that the same thing is happening at home. In fact, I one day thought that it may be even better for me to get resources to start a private company from government rather than do not-for-profit work, because that budget has shrunk so low. And the issue also is that the charitable law we have in Canada more or less see charity as handout rather than ability to build people's capacity to play leadership role in their various societies and their various environment. Therefore, the question is, do you agree with this observation? And if you agree with it, what do you think we can do to change the domestic scene in Canada to empower the civil society to be able to engage in change of power relations abroad?
Thanks, Lamberto. Right, Honorable. Is that okay? Do you mind? Yeah, you can just go there. Yep.
First of all, on graphs, the point I was trying to make with that graph, and I don't think I ever promised not to show it. If I do, I renege on that promise. If I did, I renege on that promise, is precisely that the GDP calculations are not enough. And my argument would be that we have become fixated in Canada recently on GDP and economic preoccupations. That's relatively new in Canada, that fixation is. And the reason I make the point is that it indicates that if we're putting all of our, if we are pinning all of our hopes on that strand succeeding, we better recognize that one of the changes that is occurring in the world is that other countries are becoming much more effective in that sphere than we are. So we shouldn't stop focusing on questions of economic growth as well as questions of equity and related questions. But we have to realize that if we are going to be as significant a society as we could be, we have to emphasize more than simply our economic dimension. On the, I'm not going to comment upon, even indirectly, upon policies of the present government with regard to its involvement in society. I don't agree with them, and I think that there has, I have frank, except to say this, I don't think there's much of a mandate for it. I think the government got elected for reasons other than their views on either internal or international development. And that leads me to what is my more hopeful point, which I can't adduce any kind of statistical evidence. I think that this is a more generous country than its public policy suggests. And so I think that there is an opportunity for people in whatever domain we work who want to call forth those more generous instincts to do that. And I think that rather than hacking away at a government that might be doing things we don't like, there's no harm in doing that, but rather than concentrating on that, I think we need to be looking for ways in which we can encourage those more generous instincts in the country to be expressed, whether they are expressed internally. The point that Naresh made about people not being prepared to surrender power willingly is clearly the case. I think what people are prepared to do, even people who might want to guard their own privileges, they are prepared to try to find ways to encourage a larger voice for people who do not have those privileges. And I think we need to be encouraging those instincts in the country.
Naresh and Phil, do you want a few? Well,
I should just add that that the idea of civil society action being sort of misunderstood as charity is sort of a, I think, a misunderstanding. And if that's the perception that there is in this country, then clearly we need some action to change that perception. That change of perception, I would imagine, cannot come from a dictate from anywhere excepting through civil society action itself, that perception will change. All over the world, even in the aid business in which we are, you know, aid business is no longer seen as handouts from a rich country to a poor country. The current conception of aid is a partnership for development. And in fact, we talk more about development cooperation rather than giving aid to countries. Now, while the aid that we give to countries is in fact still there, what we are trying to move to is to understand aid as a small and limited instrument in a bigger challenge. And so even when we use the human rights-based approach to development, it is a moving away from charity to one of obligation and rights. So for me, the whole world is moving away from that, and I'll be surprised if that's the case. It might very well be, and if it is, the action must come from the Canadian people.
Just a couple of points. The first is to pick up on something that Naresh is saying. Charity is important. It's important that people who have money donate, to be blunt. But a relationship of charity to the receiver is inherently unequal. Collaboration is the way to go, and that requires not necessarily that everybody be equal in material terms, but it requires a level of respect, and it requires a willingness to listen and engage in a way that, that the idea of charity really misses by its definition, because it's, you know, noblesse oblige, and that's important, but that's not what we're talking about here. The second thing, and picking up on a couple of things that both Mr. Clark and Naresh said, you know, oftentimes what we forget is what makes Canadian democracy work. And if you look at anything that happens, not everything, but a lot of times what it is the quality and the influence of different civil society actors. And I think that oftentimes what's most instructive, most insightful, is when things don't work right. And so Montreal, the last few months, has been going through all sorts of political problems because of various scandals, corruption, etc. Why do we know about that? Because of an active press, because of different NGOs and social movements that are bringing it to light. And it's that kind of process, oftentimes that becomes most apparent when things aren't working as well as they might, that leads to hope, because it's a recourse. It means that there's mechanisms for self-correction, etc. And if it doesn't start in civil society, it's likely not to start anywhere.
I have three questions. Because I don't know your names, I'm just going to go by row number. So the fifth row, the gentleman in the gray shirt, and then we have the fourth row, and then the sixth row.
My name is Sam Goldberg. I'm a McGill alumnus. I'm sorry to say, but the panel left me with something of a dilemma. Because on the one hand, we were told the importance of empowerment and the need for civil society action. At the same time, we were told that the existing power structures are not intended to be collaborative and that the wealthy and powerful are not going to give power easily. So my question, therefore, becomes, when's the epiphany? How are we going to arrange this transformation that all of you are suggesting is necessary, but yet at the same time, we don't seem to know how we can go about doing it in an effective way without having a few leaders lose their heads in the process?
I think that's a great question. Which of my colleagues would like to jump in first?
Well, thanks very much for that question. I think that's at the heart of it, and we need to really debate and discuss this. Let me say at the outset that obviously we don't know the answer, and otherwise we would have said it already, right? So You picked on us in the right spot, but we do have some ideas on how to go forward. I think step one, like in all social change, all through the history of human civilization, has been preceded by an idea. And the first thing is that idea. I think the big idea that we have to deal with at the conceptual level, the first thing is how to reconceptualize power as a positive-sum game. The issue is that if the disempowered, if it is seen that when they get power, those who have power are losing power, now they might lose some, but if that game is shown that the cake can be in fact bigger, not necessarily a fixed power cake, and it does change and can get bigger, then we have a chance. Then we have a way to begin the negotiation. So that's point number one, a conceptual shift on how we understand power. After that, we need to begin to work with where we can find champions. And I'm getting very concrete and pragmatic. We will have to work in some places where we can win. We cannot win in many places now on the planet, but there are places, countries, communities in which we can win. That is to say, where people are able to work with those groups I mentioned, where people have formed organizations that are strong and are ready to champion change. One example, SEWA, the Self-Employed Women's Association in India. Ella Bhatt wrote a book called We Are Poor, But We Are Many. Her organization now has 70,000 women. It's that strong. The government of India listens to such an organization. When you get the people around the airport in Bombay to form a strong group, no one gets elected now unless that group votes for that person. So the government wants it to lengthen the runway in Mumbai. They can't do it because the group says, it's unless you give us better housing, we're not going to vote for you if that's your policy. So tell us what you're going to do, and then we'll decide how to vote. In other words, all over the world, people are now being able to change the policies that control their lives. But it's not everywhere yet. It's starting, and it's growing. And I believe as we learn from those examples and we celebrate them, we have hope for change. Might be very difficult. That is true. Extremely difficult. And the truth is some people will lose their lives in this change process. But there fortunately have always been leaders who have been prepared to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I more or less agree with everything Naresh said, but I'm going to talk about it from a slightly different perspective. You know, I've studied and sort of worked with poor people all over Latin America, and what I think is most positive and very important to recognize is that they have a lot of patience. I mean, they don't expect the revolution to come tomorrow, and in fact, that's why you don't see very many revolutions, because the poor people have a lot to lose, and it's only under very extreme situations. Now, I say that because what it means is that gradual change can go a long way. And this is why I talk about the paradox of Latin America. They like democracy more than ever, but they don't like the democratic governments they're getting. And that's the challenge, is to reward people's patience. And how do you do that? You help them organize themselves. You make organization and participation relevant by inclusion. And there have to be some gains. And if we look at the cases, Naresh mentioned a couple of them, there are a lot that we don't notice all the time because they're kind of under the radar screen, or they're not dramatic enough to catch our attention. But if you think about a lot of indicators of basic rights today compared to 15 years ago, there's been a lot of change. There's been some retrocession too, and one can argue that reflects a lot of weakening of civil society. But the point is that if we have the proper lens and frame it, then there is a lot of potential, and I think that we need to keep expectations reasonable. So slow change can go a long, long way. The problem is when there's stagnation or reversal of change.
If I may, I'm going to pick up for a moment on something Phil just said, because I think this. I think we may not be looking seriously enough at this discrepancy between a desire to have democracy and a lack of satisfaction with governments. It is easier to articulate dissatisfaction than it is to identify solutions or to involve people in their achievement. So there is a necessary, there's an inevitable challenge here that we have to look at. The experience of others in this room in the developing world is probably greater than my own, but what depresses me most of all in Africa is the sense of cynicism about the possibility of change. Even in countries where one could say objectively some change is happening. And that's because the mobilization has been done by encouraging people to express their dissatisfaction. And we have some sense as to how to do that. We don't have enough sense, although your study may be identifying some avenues as to how we give effect to that. On the, I want to speak about the developed world for a second. I want to speak about us in terms of epiphanies. I don't think there will be an epiphany, but I think there are some changes. And I want to go back to a Canadian tradition. I'm not sure about power never being given away, never being zero sum. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about Canadian history has been what is called in this province the caisse populaire tradition, what's called in English-speaking Canada the co-op tradition, the credit unions. There has been a sense, not necessarily to give away power, but to recognize that power, influence, progress is going to be achieved collectively. That's a fairly strong sense in this country, and it interestingly it appears across other category, it appears across the board. The other thing I wanted to say just quickly, I'm fascinated by corporate social responsibility in Canada. A long time ago, during the anti-apartheid campaign, there was no group in Canada more impervious to persuasion than the resource industries in Canada. They were the least socially responsible people you could think of. For a variety of reasons, some of those companies, I emphasize some of those companies, are taking a very forward-looking view now on corporate social responsibility. Why is that happening? Part of it may be generational. I think that's worth looking at. But part of it is precisely the question that some corporate leaders recognize exactly that we can enlarge the cake, and that this is not that there is a new economy and a new set of circumstances underway. That's not happening enough in the Canadian corporate community, but it is beginning to happen. And I don't think it was the result of any particular kind of public policy, I regret to say. I think that it came out of a recognition of self-interest on the part of many many corporations. So, and I agree with Phil about patience. I think there's a limit to patience. There's a limit to the patience of all of us. I think if we are looking for dramatic changes, we'll wait a long time. But there are, I think, changes on important margins, almost to a degree that you can't really call them margins. And we have to be identifying those and understanding why they're happening and determining whether some of the factors that caused them to happen can apply in comparable circumstances.
Okay, so we're getting a long speaker's list. No, that's good. We've got about seven questions now, so with about 20 minutes, that's about 3 minutes for the speaker and the question response. So, I was going to say that's what we do. Sort of, I'm going to get the first next three people to. So I have the fourth row, this gentleman here, and then I have the sixth row in the back, fellow with the glasses, and the woman right beside him. So how about the three of you start with your questions, identify yourself.
Oh, thank you. My name is David Gray. I've been working in international development for the last 35 years in governance and civil society. I think you just started to answer the question I have. Maybe you can take it a little deeper, but a lot of the literature, academic reviews and studies, donor assessments suggest that developed countries' efforts at democratic assistance and governance reform have made very, very little difference at all, that we haven't been effective in our strategies, we haven't been effective in creating real change. I know you started to talk about this around the last question, but I'm interested if you can deepen your perspectives on why we don't seem to be doing as well as we'd like to. Expectations too high, or we're just not doing it right? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Razmik Panosyan. I'm from International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development, Rights and Democracy. The three presentations were quite complementary in terms of what they emphasized, but there was also a bit of a tension between Mr. Clark's presentation and Mr. Singh's presentation, insofar as Mr. Clark really emphasized the sources of conflict that are upcoming in the future, from issues related to identity, to culture, to faith, rather than not from development, whereas the solutions that were being offered in the last presentation were really about empowerment and development. And there's a bit of a mismatch here. I mean, I understand where both of you are coming from, but can the two really sort of are working at odds with one another as well?
I'll take one last question, then we'll turn it to our speakers.
My name is Mies van der Kamp. I'm a graduate student here at McGill. I want to return to that question of empowerment, because we talked about the idea of how it could happen through an opening at the top and at the same time through slow change at the bottom. But this seemed to apply to the case of Latin America, where there's some form of democracy. And I wonder if it would apply to authoritarian countries as well. I mean, how the opening at the top would come there, and whether slow change is possible in that situation. So are there some cases where this idea of mutual empowerment can simply be written off?
All great questions. I'll turn it over to the panelists. Sure.
Briefly, so that we can get in all the other questions. The first question of promoting democracy abroad, I think we really don't know how to do it. I think we have learned a lot, however, on how not to do it. And I think that augurs well for the future. And I believe that rapidly we are, as we try learn what to avoid and how to promote democracy, we are going to get better and better at doing it. And I think that's beginning to happen. It's obviously not going to happen from a government trying to impose democracy on another nation. Clearly that's not going to work. But the combination of large networks of global civil society actors interacting around the globe is going to be perhaps the most powerful force that drives this. And civil society actors from north and south working together I believe will be a real powerful change. Democracy has been growing in a strange way. If you look at the number of countries by, you know, Freedom House measures or whatever other measures, it's been progressive somehow. Some have retrograded, have gone backwards. But I think that that's the way we have, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know the work of Tom Carruthers and others, and looking at how we've done this, and I think a lot of lessons have been learned. We now need to implement those lessons learned. On the second question of, you know, Mr. Clark talking more about some of the future, having some of these potential for conflicts and cultures and elsewhere, and my focusing on an intersection of economics and law or development and law, I will just put one thing on the table, and it will be interesting to see what Mr. Clark has to say on this as well. And that is, I believe, like a recent book, and I think it's called Guerrilla Diplomacy or something, one of our people here has written an interesting book. I believe the future of diplomacy will be around the sustainable development paradigm. Not a diplomacy that is driven so much by state actors acting on defense issues, but in humanity working towards a shared prosperity. And that will be defined by the sustainable development paradigm. I believe the new breed of diplomat will have to understand that. And that defined broadly will include culture and the other forces that drive such a paradigm. When we look at it in that broader picture, I believe that that will reconcile what he said and what I said. And the third issue, let me put a blunt thing on the table. And in authoritarian states, a completely different set of actions are required, in my view. I'll give you one example. When I was working in this commission, I was told that one of the most important countries I should test these ideas in or go to would be Zimbabwe. I refused. I believed that my energies would be better spent elsewhere. And that might appear to you to be running away from the real problem, but there are a small number of states in which the actions to change those countries are different. I mean, I don't have to go through the list on how we have changed authoritarian state. Apartheid, perhaps, was the most powerful authoritarianism ever, and it was changed. Mr. Clark knows very well how to change those things, so we leave that to him.
Okay, about democratic assistance, just really quickly, I think that the first thing to remember is that democracy has elections, but it's more than that. And I think that for me, a kind of a working definition is really democratic governments are accountable and responsive. That's what elections are supposed to do. If you don't like the government, they're thrown out of office so they're made accountable. And the converse is they have to be responsive, otherwise they're not going to win elections. And obviously, there are other ways to do that. And I think that we need to get a more holistic vision of democracy, not to say that elections aren't central, but to say that elections are a goal, which is the second thing I want to say. Is, you know, I said poor people have a lot of patience up to a certain point. Sometimes donors don't have enough patience, too. Sometimes their policies are geared more toward their own arbitrary electoral cycles than the requirements of building democracy in countries where they're trying to promote it. Now, it's very easy to learn to be a Democrat. Look what's happening in Iran to this day, where people without any democratic tradition are saying the votes weren't counted fairly. It's not rocket science. But to create the institutions that can count votes fairly and make sure they're counted fairly, to create the institutions that make elections meaningful in terms of accountability and responsiveness, that takes time. It may take 5 years, it may take 10 years, but you can't put a preset timetable on these things. And if you try and do that, you're only asking for trouble. Which is the third thing. Part of the problem with democracy promotion is consistency. And so for me, I think one of the really good example is the controversy over the elections in Afghanistan and the predetermination that elections can't be free and fair in Honduras of the current government conducts them. And I'm not saying that that's wrong or what I'm right. What I'm saying is, what's the message? You know, you have to be consistent and take the and pay the costs of consistency, which means working backwards. You have to have realistic time frames. You have to understand that democracy has elections, but not maybe tomorrow. In terms of the, I'm going to jump in real quickly on the Naresh Mr. Clark controversy and just say very, very simply that for me, the key is in state civil society relations. And for example, unless civil society is present, the kinds of laws aren't necessarily going to be the right kinds of laws. that they may establish property rights, but they may not establish them in the way that's most in accordance with various aspects of particular societies. And in fact, what civil society working with the state or even not working with the state, and this is why Canadian democracy, I think, has been successful in the ways that Mr. Clark mentioned, is that a lot of conflict mediation takes place within civil society before it blows up in people's faces. In terms of empowerment, the last question, very quickly, authoritarianism by definition constrains civil society, period. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have trade-offs. And so very, very quickly, you know, South Korea, Taiwan, maybe Japan to a certain extent, they were less democratic in the sense that I'm talking about here. But in exchange, the trade-off was very impressive levels of growth, rapid rises in income, and even a very appreciable level of equality. So it's not to say that that's what I would prefer, but we can understand it in that way. And I think that's the perspective that we need to apply when we're looking at regimes that are blatantly not democratic in this sense and don't want to be.
I think often we're imposing inappropriate models of democracy, and we have to take account of the circumstances of the societies in which we are trying to encourage self-expression and self-determination. And as someone who has gone around reading from handbooks and applying them in election observation and other things, I look back and realize how often we were wrong, how often we were recommending processes that simply don't work in the circumstances where we were applying them. My view about the culture faith issue is that it has changed the game. I think that there was a time in which, and first of all, I think the relation between what we were saying is that so long as inequality and blatant poverty continue to be the norm, that creates a constituency for people who can be mobilized to assertive and narrower views. It's not the only cause, but it creates a constituency that can be exploited. And I think one of the really interesting questions about civil society in these times is whether the civil society that we've been talking about is going to be able to moderate the cultural assertiveness we're finding, or whether the cultural assertiveness, by contrast, will make civil society more difficult to function. Because civil society involves, of course, it involves finding common interests, but it also involves some sense of concession. And very often when there is this driving force of cultural assertiveness, one of the first casualties is a willingness to concede to another point of view. You know, I have trouble sometimes knowing, Zimbabwe's a good case, what is an authoritarian regime? There are regimes where I have been actively involved in devising a new electoral system and supervising elections that are nominally democratic, that sign on to all the charters, but that are de facto authoritarian. I think that one of the things that could be done about that, in some circumstances, is that I think that the organizations to which those countries belong, their so-called peers, should be tougher in expressing their expectations, and it should be tied to assistance. I'm sorry to speak in code. I'll stop speaking in code. I led a Commonwealth delegation twice into Cameroon, a country that has some very interesting parallels to Canada, except by any de facto definition, Cameroon is an authoritarian state, and we treat it as a democracy, and we go in and lament occurrences that happen there, but the Commonwealth, la Francophonie, the Canada, we don't do anything about it. And I think that, among other things, what that will do is drive some of the people who have become, who are potential leaders of civil society, will drive them into more violent and extreme measures. On your larger question, Denise, I can't answer that. I don't know. I don't have that kind of experience with authoritarian regimes of the kind you're talking about. My experience has been more often with those that claim to be something else, but in fact are pretty authoritarian.
The next three. So I have the gentleman here in the third row. I then have the woman here in the orange, and then back to you, sir, in the white. So that'll be the last three questions.
Great. My name is Jason Pierman. I'm a long-time volunteer for Engineers Without Borders. I'm also doing some stuff on one of the City of Ottawa's advisory committees, and I'm pretty engaged in that respect in terms of, you know, just being a global citizen and trying to change how Canada develops and interacts with the world on a larger stage. But my day job is a public servant, so the panel's been fantastic. Has been fantastic with, you know, really energizing me to stay participated in events that, you know, pulls Canadians and tries to get us as a community to do larger things. But I chose to go into the public service versus NGOs or the private sector because I really wanted to have my impact, to have the ability to be multiplied. So I guess my question is, how do you see public servants really moving, whether it's the government or just our departments, to be moving towards developing positive some policies overall, and whether it's corporate social responsibility or Bill C-293 with CETA and development accountability? How do we get, how do we empower young public servants, I guess that's myself, to move some of the, our larger institutions in that direction? Thanks.
Hi, my name is Erin. I'm doing my PhD in the Faculty of Education here. And so I'm going to address your second example, Dr. Oxhorn, which relates to education. First, I was just disappointed that you didn't mention a little bit more about the context. In terms of the neoliberal economic policies which caused the increase in privatization in Chile's education system. But I really want to address your last point about the result of community involvement in the education sector, because I disagree that the result of having a community involved would be their recognition that education is valuable for their children. I mean, I would believe that they already recognize this. I think that most people believe that their children should go to school, and they want that for them. But if the public education system isn't working or is of poor quality, then they could probably question the value in sending them there. So my question is, do you have an example, and perhaps I'm putting you on the spot, but an example of where some of the changes we've talked about here, systemic changes, where power was shifted, do you have examples of where that occurred, where a community was involved? Because I think if that's our goal here, then we need to learn from those case studies and those examples.
Yes, thank you. My name is Fidelis. I'm a PhD candidate in the School of Urban Planning, and my PhD is towards improving participatory multi-stakeholder water governance at the local level, and I'm using Cameroon as a case study. I'm so impressed when he said CETA will sit on the same table for 40 years doing the same thing, and won't go anywhere. And the talk today is centered on one thing I'm taking away. It seems to me that the burden has been pushed back to the civil society. But let us look at Africa. We put it in context, where the Right Honorable seems to have worked in Cameroon, where I come from, where we all know it takes two to dialogue. And most of these governments won't dialogue. And they will use everything at their power to push civil society to the extremes. Now, I didn't quite get much some of the mechanisms which civil societies can use to, self-empowerment. But again, is it not hypocrisy? Do we want to call it diplomacy? That international communities and diplomats sit around the table with people they call dictators and at the same time support their actions. In Cameroon, we recently got a fake thing called Elections Cameroon that has everybody in there was picked from the political party in power. And yet we seem to claim every day in Cameroon that Canada was highly consulted in this process. The Right Honorable Amin gave partial answer to my question that our peers are not doing enough. And we know that without separation of power, this will continue. The market and the policies are not they are not doing it, so we need to take more sanctions. And the question is it diplomacy or hypocrisy?
Diplomacy or hypocrisy? Perfect. We'll turn the right honorable.
Okay, I'm going to leave Phil to defend himself, Aaron, on your second question. I want to, on the question of public servants and the value of governments, I want to come back to a point I tried to make in my opening presentation, that while there is no doubt that the source of imagination and innovation is turning more and more to non-state actors, we remain an institutional world. Governments are extremely important, and encouraging people who are inclined to serve in public service is more important now than ever, I think. So one shouldn't worry about a role. How do you, to answer your question more directly, people here may have thought about this more consecutively than in a more organized way than I have. I come from a different era in the government of Canada. I was privileged to be the foreign minister during a time when there was a great deal of internal discussion within the public service and between, I think I can say this, I can speak of my own department, between myself as minister and my public servants. It was quite open. That's in a very hierarchic department, and we were able to find ways, I think it's fair to say, around the hierarchy. We weren't the only ones. I wasn't the only minister to do that. That wasn't the only era to do that. That can be done. And for my sins, I've been involved in a multitude of consultations with Canadian publics, which generally have been quite constructive, I think. And I think that we need to try to return to that emphasis upon that kind of active consultation, that active cooperation between people who serve the public interest from different positions, those who are official public servants and those who are engaged in NGOs and non-state organizations who have the public interest very much at heart. I think there needs to be that kind of openness and discussion. And I'm proof that it can work. I mean, I have seen it work. It's not theoretical to me. On hypocrisy and diplomacy, let me talk about Cameroon, and let me take very personally this ELECAM, because I co-chaired the committee from which ELECAM emerged. But before, and I was there as the Commonwealth representative. And ELECAM is if one looked at it as an institution, it's the electoral body in Cameroon. If one looked at it as an institution, you would say, that's pretty good, except that the government appoints all the commissioners. And when our process, the process in which I was involved on the Commonwealth's behalf, wearing my Canadian flag, when we reached the point where we were looking at ways in which we could constrain that, we were suddenly not invited back to meetings. Now, what did we do about that? Nothing. We did nothing about that. And that is where I think this question of peer pressure arises. I don't want to pretend it's simple. It can be done bilaterally. To some degree, Canada's High Commissioner in Cameroon has tried to be fairly effective on some of these issues. What interests me is whether or not we can bring some life into some of the organizations, more specifically the Commonwealth, which causes people to sign on to certain declarations of principle, and then we do very little to enforce them. I understand the constraints of organizations of sovereign countries having to respect the sovereignty of each of their member states, but I was there in the anti-apartheid campaign. I saw people being prepared to intrude on what was traditionally the jurisdiction of a state and to try to bring peer pressure to bear. It can be done, and I think that we need to be looking at it more seriously, because if we don't, you know Cameroon much better than I do, but my sense of Cameroon is that it is a place it is one of the places in the world which everyone might think is peaceful, but where an explosion could be waiting to occur. And if there is not some intervention by people who have in good conscience sat down with Cameroonian leaders and agreed on general principles, if there's not some effort made to try to enforce those principles, to cause people to respect them, then we are inviting, I think, we are making more likely that kind of unfortunate result.
So, about the public servants, in 1989, the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, which is a UN organization, published a report that was called Productive Transformation with Equity. And the idea, which is very consistent with what you're saying, is that, look, in Latin America, if it was ever the truth, it no longer is the case that you can have economic development, much less sustained economic growth, based on low wages. So the only way that the economies are going to be able to develop and grow in a sustained way is by dealing with basic equity issues, including education. Because to do well in these economies that are being more and more globalized, the elites can no longer isolate themselves, and they're dependent much more than ever before on a productive labor force. And the reason I'm mentioning that, aside from the parallels with what Naresh was saying, is that it just didn't happen in practice. And the reason it didn't happen is because well-intentioned, or usually well-intentioned, public service didn't look for the kinds of policies that would mediate and broker and look for these positive-sum gains. And so I think part of the question is the perspective. You have to go out looking for these things. You have to talk to the different stakeholders. And we're seeing more and more of that. And, you know, one of the reasons that I became a professor is to have a multiplier effect, too, although I may not succeed. The idea is to teach students in the university to have these kinds of open perspectives, because if public servants, however well-intentioned, don't look for these opportunities and help create them in the presentation of policy alternatives, it's very, very difficult to conceive. Now, I think ECLAC was right in 1989, but we're still waiting to see the fruits of that, because public servants haven't taken the message to heart. Now, in terms of education, I agree with everything you said, and I may have misspoken. What I wanted to say and what I believe in is exactly what you said. The reason why community involvement works is because communities already know that. It's not that they learn this because they're involved. It's when they're allowed to be involved that they're able to realize what they already know. But when systems are closed, when the influence is closed, people make a rational choice. Look, if my son or daughter is going to be in school for 4 years and earn the same amount of income 4 years later that he or she will earn today, it's better that they're getting a job, because that means there's more food on the table. It means we're leaving a little bit better. So why waste the 4 years? In terms of examples, I think that I agree it's neoliberalism. There's a lot of reasons. That's why I mentioned Chile. But it's not only Chile. There's a sea change in how education is delivered in a lot of different places. But in terms of concrete examples, the Inter-American Development Bank has done some studies. But think about Canada, think about the United States, the famous parent-teacher organizations, the school boards. All of these are supposed to be, and maybe not as much today as they were 30, 40 years ago, were mechanisms through which the community can influence what's going on in education. So there's plenty of examples. Sometimes we just don't see them. Now, I'm not going to defend Mr. Clark, just like he won't defend me, but I will make a point about hypocrisy, because it's consistent. It harks back to something I said in the last round of interventions. I think the only way to avoid hypocrisy, which doesn't mean you're right or wrong, it just means you're not a hypocrite, is to be consistent and use consistent criteria. If you want to succeed and be right, you have to listen and cooperate and not impose. And that's the dilemma, trying to work with societies in a democratic way that may not necessarily have the same ideal of democracy. But the only way not to be hypocritic is to be consistent and to have clear criteria. And unfortunately, Mr. Clark, obviously aside, much of the international community, for good reasons and not so good reasons, is often blatantly inconsistent. And the people who find that democracy promotion is most threatening are the first people to point to those inconsistencies, because it gives them leverage that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Naresh.
Things on the education issue, if you don't mind, two examples that came to my mind are the Chicago school boards. When they modified them and the community participated on the boards, it's well documented the dramatic shift in the quality of the education that occurred in Chicago in the developed world. And in the developing world in sub-Saharan Africa, there's been several studies on why poor kids don't do well at school. And engaging the community and through participatory exercises, very interesting results of why poor kids don't do well at school. Apart from the physiological challenges, if they don't have good meals and stuff, which are there, those were not the major reasons. One is their schooling had little to do with their education, to use the old Mark Twain quote when he said he never allowed his schooling to interfere with his education. And the issue is that what they were learning at school had very little to do with how they would make their living. The relevance couldn't be seen. The second thing was the timing of the school term. The colonial days imposed a school term in which you had school classes at the time of harvest when their labor is needed and the harvesting fields and stuff. So you had to reorient and a bunch of reasons like that. And the only way to figure out what to do about it was the engagement of the community as another concrete example, just to steal a little bit from your work there. But the last point I wanted to make, and believe it is not on the public service, because I understand we have at least two deputy ministers in the room, at least one former associate deputy minister in the room, and a former prime minister. So obviously I can't be qualified in this audience to say anything about how to be a better, more engaged public servant. But the last one I wanted to make was in the self-empowerment process as a concluding point. Because the questions that were raised and our whole theme today address this. And let me just close by saying these four simple steps of how self-empowerment actually takes place from what I've observed, apart from all the conversations we've had. Step one is articulation. People have to begin to talk about their issues and to be encouraged to talk. And that's not so difficult to do. So articulation, where people talk about their issues. And the second step is mobilization, where people form groups. And we've seen that happen in, you know, large number of places. Mobilization, people get together, they form groups. The third step in that process is the biggest challenge, and that is the redistribution of power. So it's now comes the time of debate, negotiation, diplomacy, and the reordering of how people engage with institutions. That's the distribution of power issue. That's the biggest challenge, and that's the third step. And the fourth step is confirmation, where the changes you get must be enshrined in the law so that future generations don't have to fight the same battles. And those four steps I have seen work. I will leave it at that. Articulation, mobilization, distribution, and finally confirmation.
Thank you very much, Naresh. The time is over. I have three quick little jobs to do. First, colleagues, on behalf of all of you, it's to thank our amazing panel. I think it is rare that I've seen, and it speaks to the commitment that each of these people have, that on a Friday afternoon in Montreal at McGill, these people would give up their time to come and speak to us about what is such an important issue. So on behalf of all of you, if we could give them a round of applause. The other aspect also, you have participated in that, it is, I can tell you as a facilitator, having 6 and 8 people lining up for questions and making sure they were profound questions. They had all of these panelists thinking and making notes. So thank you for your participation in terms of actively getting involved, because I'm a firm believer that it's the dialogue that is at least as interesting as the presentation. So thank you very much for coming. And finally, probably the pleasant, we're having a reception in honor of our guests right outside the doors. And so you're all invited to come and sort of mingle and talk to some people. The advantage of having this on a Friday afternoon is you can spend the weekend talking to your friends about what you learned. And in that way, the ripple effect starts. So on behalf of the Canada School and McGill, the University of McGill, I'd like to thank you for being a part of this second international series, and more to come. So thank you very much.